This morning, we're going to finish the story of Isaac and the wells and the pact with Avimelech, and then move on to the beginning of a discussion, which we will resume with our next class, about Jacob and Esau. So maybe to refresh our memories, we should go to 26:23, chapter 26, verse 23. And to a great extent, Isaac's active life is over. And what I mean by that is his blessing. The blessing is in part his being the victim of trickery, but the thing that he does, what his accomplishment is in the world, is unsealing the wells that his father dug and calling them by the names that his father chose. And he has now done that, right? And he also in this is going to make a pact with Avimelech to ensure his stability, his financial stability, and also the stability of the people around him. And here's where God blesses him. From there he went up to Beersheba. That night the Lord appeared to him and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Fear not, for I'm with you, and I will bless you and increase your offspring for the sake of my servant Abraham. We talked about this last time, that it's no great compliment to Isaac that God will only do this for Abraham's sake, but that the concept of zechut avot, the merit of the fathers, is which really begins here, because Isaac is the first one with a father that could accumulate this merit, is a very important and powerful concept in the Jewish tradition, right? That's why when we pray, we invoke the forefathers, and in our prayer book, the four mothers as well, four as in not F-O-U-R, but F-O-R-E, that is those who came before. And the reason we do that is, although it turns out, you know, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah are four, but when we say four mothers, I just want to make clear we're not talking the number. But the idea of your being special to God because those who preceded you, who are in your lineage, are special to God, is a very old and powerful idea in the Jewish tradition. And that's why we ask over and over again in various places in the prayer book, save us not for our sake, but for the sake of our ancestors. And that's and ancestors doesn't have to be literally genealogical, right? There's a famous letter written by Maimonides in answer to a convert by the name of Ovadia. Ovadia writes him and says, how can I say that I am of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? You know, it's not my God that's not the God that I grew up with. And Maimonides writes back and explains that it's a spiritual lineage, not a direct biological lineage. And he says, by the way, that he has more right to say it than most Jews since he chose Judaism. Anyway, in this sentence is contained that idea, which is analogous to the idea of your treating the children of your friends well. If you love someone and they have children, they're going to be more special to you than a stranger's kids. And the same is true here. God cares for Isaac because of Abraham, although God forges also a new relationship in a way with Jacob and with Joseph. It seems as though Isaac is the sort of the bridge generation. So he built an altar there, which is the reaction, as we've seen before, to God's revelation. That is, you build an altar to God, which makes religion a response, not an initiation, which is an important thing, that Judaism is a response to God's initiative as opposed to a human initiative to which God responds. Okay? That is, God first appears to Isaac, and Isaac builds an altar. So he built an altar there and invoked the Lord by name. Isaac pitched his tent there, and his servants started digging a well. There's a big well motif here with Isaac. And we talked about that both literally and also metaphorically, what it means to dig a well. And Avimelech came from Gerar with Ahuzad, his counselor, and Phicol, chief of his troops. Isaac said to them, why have you come to me, seeing you've been hostile to me and driven me away from you? And they said, we now see plainly the Lord's been with you, and we thought, let there be a sworn treaty between our two parties, between you and us. Let's make a pact with you that you won't hurt us, and just as we haven't hurt you, but have always dealt kindly with you and sent you away in peace. which is not entirely true, but all right. So they make a pact, they exchange oaths, they call the name Shiva, we talked about the name Beersheba, and then Esav is 40 years old. He takes a wife from, two wives from Hittites, and they're a source of bitterness to both father and mother. And now, so you have a stable situation of two older children and an older parent, and clearly Isaac is not going to live that much longer, and it's time to bless his children and give them the birthright. Now we know, remember the backstory, that that Jacob has already, in some sense, taken, stolen, whatever, the birthright because of the story with the cakes in the field, right? I mean, with the lentils in the field, right? Esau comes in from the field, he's very hungry, he says, I want something to eat. Jacob says, well, he actually doesn't even say I'm very hungry. He says, I'm starving to death, essentially, I'm famished. Jacob says, all you have to do is sell me the birthright and you can have these delicious lentils right here. And of course, Esau does. He says, what do I care about the birthright when I'm about to die? And he takes it and spurns the birthright. Now, it seems as though Isaac doesn't know anything about this story, because if he did, then Jacob could just argue his case in front of Isaac. And that's, I think, part of what makes readers believe that that was not an entirely legitimate corralling of the birthright. Because if it were, and everybody agreed it was legitimate, so then you would say, all right, so Esau made a bad deal, but you have to live with it. Sometimes you make a bad deal, and that's what you got to do. It doesn't seem that way from the fact that Jacob has to fool him. So, all right, let's start at the beginning here. Even though, and there's a lot, there's an awful lot about this story, as you might expect. I will give you a broad outline, which is that the action in its entirety, says Sarna, covers this chapter and the next chapter and unfolds in seven scenes. All four members of the family participate, but only in pairs. You never see three of them together, right? Neither Jacob and Esau nor Rebekah and Esau appear together. They dare not confront each other. Each pair moves to the stage of the center twice, save mother and father, who meet but once, and that briefly. The strong-willed, artful Rebekah prefers to hover inconspicuously in the background, manipulating the situation. She approaches her husband only when matters threaten to get out of hand. Okay? All the action and dialogue is directed towards the recurring theme of the entire episode, the father's final blessing. The birthright, he says, is not an issue here, and its relationship to the blessing is unclear. Apparently, they were separate institutions. Nothing is said about the disposition of property, and it's striking that Esau is expected to receive the blessing, even though he admits to having lost the birthright. So the relationship between the birthright and the blessing is something that we will look at, but they seem somehow different, and you'll see by the blessings that Isaac gives that they're not entirely the same. All right. When Isaac was old, and his eyes were too dim to see. Now, he lives for a while after this. It's not that he's on his deathbed, but he is old and blind. Why is Isaac blind? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear. Well, no, not because of Joseph, because Joseph is going to be his grandchild. Jacob is going to mistakenly bless, or on purpose bless, Manasseh instead of Ephraim. But, yeah. Okay, the rabbis say that when Isaac was bound on the altar, the angels wept and their tears fell into Isaac's eyes and blinded him, which is a very nice metaphorical way of saying that that incident somehow caused him a psychological trauma that blinded him. But, yeah. Okay, you could, I suppose, assume that it's his decision not to see. Maybe he doesn't like what he sees, although it doesn't seem that he was blind before this, which is part of the problem, right? If it's the Akedah that blinds him, why wasn't he blinded right after the Akedah? There's no indication that he was, right? So, yeah.
Wasn't there foreshadowing in the previous chapter where when Rebecca comes, when he's in the field?
And puts the veil? We probably did, and now I don't remember what. I'll tell you what it says. This is, we're talking about... Right, but that's, I mean, I see it. I don't remember what the foreshadowing is. I'm looking at the, it's in chapter 24, verse 65. But she takes a veil and covers herself. The servant told Isaac all the things he's done. He then brought her into the tent. I suppose the foreshadowing is she sees him and he doesn't say that he sees her. But it doesn't indicate before this that he's blind. Yeah. But why doesn't he go blind after the Akedah then? Why does he go blind after a lifetime of wells and success and riches and children and all of that?
Maybe,
yes. Doctor. Oh, the doctor. I want to ask the doctor. Give me a yes. Right. Yes. Right. It does actually. Vetikahenu enough. Yeah. Vatika Henry Nav, right, does mean his eyes grew dim. So, yes, go ahead.
It says the incense that Asa's wives offered to their idols.
There you go. That was it. The incense, you see how much the rabbis like Esau. The incense that Esau's wives offered to their idols blinded Isaac. Look, here's, Now, okay, let me defend that explanation since it is on the face of it ridiculous, which is I'm serious, we all laughed at it, but what's the reasoning behind it? The reasoning behind it is, remember, the Torah is not broken up into chapters. So you have a sentence that says Esau's wives were a source of bitterness to Isaac and Rebekah, and the next sentence is Isaac goes blind. So it's very, the connection, the rabbis say, why does it mention the wives right before his blindness? There must be a connection, and they make the connection midrashically. It only sounds ridiculous when you don't follow the chain of thought, but when you do, it has sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to support that connection. Two things. In my translation, it says his eyes dimmed from seeing.
From seeing. Yeah, you could translate it that way. Okay. In other words, the rebellion being Esau.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, right. You could. There's also a verbal connection or a verbal trigger, let's say. All right. So it was the incense. Nice try, nice try, doctor. But it was the incense. Of Esau, right. And this actually, let me say something about that. That you could make a good paper on that. That in fact, no matter how much your parents traumatize you, it's always worse when your kids do, right? You know? It doesn't matter. Okay, so my father tried to kill me, but it's my kid that's really killing me. Like that famous old Sam Levinson line that they used to print on T-shirts, that insanity is hereditary, you get it from your children, right? So, poor Sam Levinson, this line is now so well known that nobody knows who said it, but that's who said it. anyway. Whatever the cause, whether it was medical or psychological or some combination thereof, his eyes were dimmed, too dim to see, or you could say meraot, too dim from seeing. The statement may also have a figurative significance. That's Sarna. Isaac's perception about Esau's worthiness is cloudy, right? He thinks Esau's worthy, but we know that Esau isn't. Okay. So, he called to his older son Esav and said to him, "My son," and he answered, "Hineni." Now, Hineni is a word that we're familiar with already because that's what Abraham says when God calls him. And so, again, separating Esav from the Midrashic tradition about him, it does seem that Esav is a receptive and beloved son. And that's, you know, he answers his father the same way Abraham answers God. So there's something nice and, you know, come on, he wasn't such a bad guy. I feel bad for Esau. he doesn't even get to be, you know, the people that he gets to be the head of get wiped out anyway. It's not Ishmael, at least he gets to be the head of a people that still exist. Right, but where are the Esavites? You know, they're not.
I brought the Ezraim today, and
yes.
It talks about his blindness.
Yes.
It says that several commentators understand Isaac's blindness as emotional, not physical. Because he loved and envied Esau, he was blind to Esau's faults.
Right. So, I'm sorry, is there some, was that, yeah. So I was going to, you know, we talked about that, and it's worth mentioning again. Remember, I quoted what Jung said, that the greatest influence on the lives of children are the unlived lives of their parents, right? Esau is everything that Isaac wasn't. Now, that may be an exaggeration, because Isaac was tough enough. I mean, he stood up to Avimelech. We don't want to make him into too weak a character. But he wasn't Esav, right? Esav was stronger and not easily frightened, which is actually, for those of you who like psychology, this is a pun from Finnegan's Wake, from James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. He says, when we were young and easily frightened. So I didn't blame James Joyce. Well, he was a very, very smart man, a genius. In fact, Jung actually, one thing about Jung and James Joyce, as long as we're on the subject, which we're not, but Jung's daughter Lucia went mad. And Jung investigated, you know, the unconscious stream of consciousness writing probably more profoundly than any writer ever. And he took his daughter to see Jung, Joyce did. Joyce explored the unconscious. I don't know if I said Jung. Joyce explored the unconscious through Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake more than any writer had ever done. And he took his daughter to see Jung to see if Jung could help her. And what Jung wrote afterwards was that both daughter and father go to the bottom of the sea, but one is diving and one is drowning. In other words, Jung is doing it deliberately and in control of it. His daughter's doing the same, but she can't control it. So she's drowning even though he's diving to the unconscious, which I think is an amazing line and worth stopping the story for. Okay. All right. And he said, I am old now, and I don't know how soon I may die. Literally, I don't know the day of my death. Take your gear, your quiver and bow, go out into the open and hunt me some game. Then prepare a dish for me such as I like and bring it to me to eat so that I may give you my innermost blessing, okay, before I die. It doesn't say so I can give you the firstborn blessing. It's literally, you know, so my nefesh, my soul can bless you. Tivarechecha nafshi, so my soul can bless you. What the blessing is, we will come to. But why does he send him out to do that before the blessing? Why does he have to have him prepare game? I have a makeshift theory that actually I would not have been able to offer you before yesterday. But yesterday I read this article. Oh, did I bring? Oh, and I brought something that I want to read you as well. Yesterday I brought this art. I read this article about they did these studies and discovered that people. I don't remember what it was. Whether it was returning money or being moral in some way, people were more likely to be moral if the smell that they pumped into the room was the smell of fresh baked bread, than if they pumped a neutral smell into the room. In other words, when you feel better somehow, physically better, you're more magnanimous. You know? It's like you come home after you eat dinner, you're happier than before, and you say, okay, now I can listen to your story, right? You say to your kid who's telling you a story that you're not actually listening to anyway, but you can at least act like you're listening to because you've just eaten. And all the characters are just clouds to you. But am I giving too much away here? I try. But you know what? I must say that the intricacies of fifth grade girls sometimes escape me. And she said, and then I said, and she said. So I know this is just the beginning. I'm ratcheting up. I'm getting trained. That's good to hear. So maybe he thinks that he can give a better blessing if Esau has fed him and he's received it from his hand. Maybe this reflects self-knowledge. that if you give something to someone, then you can actually bless him with a fuller heart. Okay, I brought this because of Abraham's going down to Egypt. I just happened to read this yesterday. It's a passage from Rabbi Soloveitchik's book called Abraham's Journey, and it tells a great story, too. In Berlin, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was the leading modern Orthodox rabbi of the 20th century. He actually didn't write that many books, but he gave many, many lectures, and now his students are collecting his lectures and putting them in books. He was the Briska Rebbe, right? His family was from Brisk, and his father, I believe, was Reb Chaim of Brisk, who was a very famous Talmudist. This is in a book called Abraham's Journey. Oh, Brisk is in Eastern Europe, in somewhere in Poland. I don't know exactly where, I believe. In Berlin, I spoke with Yaakov Gromer, an associate of Albert Einstein. He was once a Talmid of my grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker. But he left Brisk and went on to become a great mathematician. All right, so he gave up study of Talmud to become a mathematician. He became Einstein's colleague, so obviously he was a good mathematician. He was not observant, but many a time you used to find him with the Gemara. He had an excellent head and could learn. He told me, when I left Brisk, I found many faults with Rev Chaim. But when I came to Berlin, I realized that Rev Chaim was a saint. They told me Einstein was considered a moral person, and he was indeed a moral person. But Rev Chaim had more chesed, kindness, in his little finger than Einstein had in all his heart and brain. Now, Soloveitchik comments on this story. One cannot understand the beauty of Judaism without encountering people of another culture. That's why Abraham had to go to Egypt, to see what Egypt was. It was fascinating at the time and very attractive. Perhaps Abraham sometimes wondered whether life wasn't better in this wonderful, powerful, respected, rich state. Nonetheless, he came out of Egypt not only regaining his identity, but spiritually more powerful. He grew to great heights. Adversity and opposition made him appreciate his own world all the more, but Lot succumbed. Right? So that's the difference between the two of them. The guy who wrote this, who is a guy named Gil Student, who has a, anyway, he writes at the bottom, in regard to something earlier, also another short story that I thought I would just mention, but since we're studying Torah, this is relevant. Friends of mine were once involved in an outreach program as Black Hat Yeshiva student mentors. They were told by the rabbi running the program that if one of the mentees asked a philosophical question, then the yeshiva student must answer, "I don't know, let's ask the rabbi." In other words, even though they had studied in the yeshiva for many years, they were told if somebody asked a philosophical question, you have to say, "I don't know, let's ask the rabbi." One of the yeshiva students asked, "Won't this give the impression that after over a decade of yeshiva study, they don't know anything?" The rabbi responded that the impression is correct. So I just want to say, that idea that you don't know anything, right, even after a decade of study, it's tough. What can I tell you? All right. So Rebecca had been listening to all of this. So it isn't just that Isaac gave this instruction to Esau, but Rebecca was listening. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the whole paradigm and imagery of sacrifice that when you get into
yeah, although well, hunting and sacrifice are a little bit different, but if it's I wonder. Let me take a look at the Hebrew and see if there's any. It's tzedah, which is it's game that's eaten. But I don't know if it's supposed to recall sacrifice. It doesn't say specifically.
Actually, I was thinking of the opposite. The sacrifice, which is so mysterious, and I think must be a projection that God will want the sacrifice, is projected from the man who wants to smell that's God.
In other words, God will be kinder to us the same way that we're kinder when someone gives us something sacrificial. That the sacrifice is like our eating, and then afterwards will be. Well, it depends if laws like sacrifice are a human projection, then it does make sense that what we think we would want, we assume that God would want. Although, you know, religion gets criticized for both, because when people in prayer flatter God, you know, oh God, you're so great, you're so great. They say, well, no human being would want that. Why would God want it? So you assume that God wants exactly what we want. On the other hand, when you give God what human beings would want, then we say, why do you assume God is like a human being? We can't win this game. So, but I think that it is clear. And by the way, I mean, clearly later thinkers like Maimonides were uncomfortable with it. It is, the thought of sacrifice is uncomfortable in the sense that it's very parallel to us. And why does God need sacrifice if God doesn't eat? Yeah. For Esau, because Esau had to work for it. Right, right. Okay, yeah.
It's also bringing out the Jacob-like qualities, because Jacob was the one who stayed home and cooked.
Yes.
So maybe he's saying, not only should you go and hunt, but I want you to bring it back and cook this for me, sort of bringing out the softer.
Oh, that's a nice idea, that we associated Jacob with cooking, but he tells Esau to cook as well, which suggests that Esau can do both. Jacob can't, you know, Esau can bring home the bacon and fry it up in a pan, as the old commercial used to have it.
It's also the second time that food is used to show, again, according to a Marxist view, how a pastoral, agricultural way of life is better than a hunting way of life.
Right. Well, it's not only a Marxist view. I mean, Gunkel, who is a German biblical scholar of the 19th century, writes about the Jacob story that the entire story should, in fact, be understood as the struggle between pastoral and agricultural ways of life, and that goes all through the Bible until essentially one wins. All right, so I think that the point, at least part of the point, is that the story works on lots and lots of different levels, and this is even before we get to all the levels that all the commentators see on it, which we will get to, but first let's make our way through the story before we look at the story anew. So now I wonder, Rebecca had been listening. I wonder how often that was true. I don't know, but it is kind of, you know, also you have to assume that these houses were not like our houses, right? They're not gigantic. It's not as though people had separate wings where other people didn't hear. So it's probably not too surprising that she heard, although, anyway. I wonder how she knew this was going to be such an important encounter. Maybe he said to her the night before, by the way, honey, I'm going to bless Esau tomorrow. You know, who knows? Yeah.
Concerned about what her husband was going to do. I mean, she...
Well, the Akedah is long before. The Akedah is when he was a little kid.
I know, but even so, from that moment...
What he was going to do about what?
How could she trust her husband?
No, you're thinking Sarah. Sarah. Right. You're thinking Sarah. Unless you could make it... unless you think that this is, you know, one of those things... Although, I assume she felt Isaac was a very different personality from Abraham. Also, by the time Esau is 40 years old and a hunter, Isaac's going to be able to tie him to an altar. Esau would stand for it. But yeah.
The other thing I was going to say is that she is so determined. She was told by God that he was going to be the one.
Right. That we will come to. Right. I just wonder how she knew that this was the time when Isaac was going to say it. But we'll see. All right, when Esau had gone out into the open to hunt game to bring home, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, I overheard your father speaking to your brother Esau, saying, bring me some game and prepare a dish for me to eat, that I may bless you with the Lord's approval before I die. Now, is that what he said?
No.
So why would she add with the Lord's approval before I die?
To make him.
I don't know. I mean, it's literally in the presence of the Lord, right? It's not literally with the Lord's approval. So, yes, go ahead.
Could it be because he said, like,
Maybe that's the translation. That could be. Maybe she's using innermost blessing. Yeah, but why would she do that? You would think that would make the blessing worse to steal. Hold on one sec. Yeah.
Maybe she wants to awaken a competitive spirit within him.
That could be. That could be. Maybe she wants to make. Yeah.
But with twins, very often it's hard to raise twins, and sometimes people raise them to be alike, and sometimes they raise them and dress them in different clothes and all that. But whatever happens, the kind of splitting of the personality into one is like one is pretty and mm-hmm. one is smart,
right.
and this and one is that. It's accentuated by the family constellation, and after Jacob goes out, he becomes much more assertive
right.
And the other side of his personality is that we already talked about Esau and the other right. side of personality. Well, they also reflect conflicts of the parents, and Rebecca has this connection with Hashem from the beginning, in which God spoke to her, gave her prophecy of the two nations who
right.
fight, and she is really very connected in a way to Hashem, where Isaac's blindness is not as connected in some way.
But I'm wondering, though, why she would say to Jacob that your father's he's going to do it in the presence of the Lord, which makes it holier, and therefore, for Jacob, worse to steal. That's what I'm wondering. Hello, yeah. That's what this commentator assumes, right. To make it so important, he's increasing the solemnity of the event. This is really, really important. This is the one where he's going to do it in front of God, so we got to get in there right away. But it seems a strange choice.
Also, it seems that Jacob is the one who's going to be continuing the line of being in service of God. So she's educating him right now that this is what it's about.
Okay, I mean, we did as well as we could. None of them entire. I got to say, none of them entirely. It seems to me that if you're going to have a kid steal the birthright, you don't say your father's about to bless your brother in God's presence. But I'll see if I can find anything on that. I don't know. It's jarring. Yeah. Well, she knows it's the moment she has to intervene, but why would she quote to Jacob? Do you understand the force of the question? Isaac says to Esau, go get me some game so I can bless you. And then she says to Jacob, Isaac said, let me bless you in front of God before I die. Yeah.
Well, if
the
natural reaction to me from Jacob would be, but wait, Mom, this isn't right.
Yeah.
But if she says, so I'm taking counter to
right.
what you said.
Yeah, that's what Sarna says. He says, Rebecca adds this phrase in Isaac's word to impress upon Jacob the importance and solemnity of the occasion. All right. I'm not sure I get it, but I'll take a look around and see if I can find someone who, if there is another answer other than the ones we've offered, which may be as good an answer as we have.
That she was arrogant?
Mm-hmm. Why would this indicate her arrogance?
Because she chose to add something.
But why did she do it? I want to know what was in her mind. What was her strategy?
So.
What was her idea? All right, let's let what?
Why? I mean, it is here, so why didn't he say, but we can't do that?
I don't know. We'll get to Jacob's reaction in a second. Not in a second, probably not for a while, but we will. To all the participants. But now, my son, listen carefully as I instruct you. Okay? Shma b'koli, which literally means listen to my voice. And it's mitzvah otach, which could also mean as I command you, not as I instruct you, right? It's the same word as mitzvah. While I listen, while I tell you what to do, you kid. Go to the flock and fetch me two choice kids, and I will make of them a dish for your father such as he likes. Now, I want to say two things about this. First of all, it must take Esau a while to hunt up some game, because she doesn't even tell him to hurry. She just says, go and fetch it, and I'll prepare it. And second, notice she puts herself in the position that Aesop was in. Right? Aesop was going to prepare the game. She's going to prepare the food. Which is funny because the one thing we know that Isaac can do is cook.
Yeah.
Right? He makes the lentils. But Maurice Samuel is right. Rebecca is the manager. She's going to do everything. She knows exactly what Isaac likes, and she wants to make it as good as possible. Yeah.
Why doesn't Aesop go to the flock and get
game? Because he's a hunter. Remember what we were just saying that this whole story is in part a contrast between the pastoral and the nomadic or hunter way of life. Then take it to your father to eat in order that he may bless you before he dies, right? If he's going to bless anyone before he dies, it should be you. And again, just as a background, he doesn't die for a while. So Jacob answered his mother, Rebekah. Now, here's Jacob's personality, right? What he says is, it might not work. He doesn't say, you can't do that. He says, but my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I'm smooth-skinned. If my father touches me, I shall appear to him as a trickster and bring upon myself a curse, not a blessing. But his mother said to him, your curse, my son, be upon me. Just do as I say, and go fetch them for me. So what does this tell you so far about the two of them? She's clearly manipulative. She knows what it is she wants. Now, she turns out to be right. Right? She turns out, and you have to think about it that way, which is it only turns out to be bad if it turns out to be wrong. If it turns out to be right that she's actually saving God's blessing for the Jewish people, then all of a sudden what she's doing is realizing what Isaac doesn't realize, that Esau is just not the one to get the birthright. But she's not only manipulative, but she also clearly has a very powerful hold on Jacob, because he does what she says after she says, don't worry about it, I'll take your curse, right? Which, again, you know, is not really hers to take if he's past the age of 13, which he seems to be. Do you know that there's a blessing that nobody says for obvious reasons except in traditional circles, that you're supposed to say when a child reaches the age of majority, that is 13 or traditionally 12 for a girl, Baruch Sheptarani Me'on Shav Shalzo, which means blessed be God who has relieved me of this burden. And the burden is not raising the child. The burden is the child's sins. Because up until the age of 13, any sin your child commits is yours. After 13, in the Jewish tradition, it's the kids, right? So you have to bear the sins of all your children until they're old enough to bear their own sins. So what Rebecca says here, you know, it seems to me it's more dismissing his concerns than really answering them, because she can't take his sins.
Well, we know that Jacob's 40 here.
Right, because Esau's 40, and by a quick calculation, right, exactly. He probably is too. Although, actually, the truth is, we don't know that. Because, again, this story you could put anywhere along the continuum of their lives. This doesn't actually have to be after Jacob gets married. After Esau gets married, just because it is written after, it doesn't mean it has to be chronologically. Remember, there's no earlier and late in the Torah. So, yeah.
That doesn't work.
Why?
If they were younger, and Isaac was about to die.
But he's not about to die. He says he's about to die, but he lives for a long time, right? No matter how you calculate it. So unless he dies, it could work. You know, I mean, he could have thought he was going to die early on. He could. So, I don't know. I'm not saying that it's not true, but still, I think that the sense of this clearly is they're not 13. You don't send, well, you could, I guess, in that world, send a 12-year-old out to hunt game. But I think it's the sense is clearly they're adult enough that Rebecca can't take the sin for him. Yeah.
Just under the...
It's not murder.
Cover of, no, I mean...
Right, yeah.
By just saying, well, godly. But she is doing so much trickery, so much immorality, so much just under the cover of.
Okay, so here's the question that I would ask you. And then, and you'll have to decide this on your own. You have two kids. One of them is a very gifted musician. And the other one is terrible at music, but is good at, I don't know, computers, whatever. And on his deathbed, their father says, please, dear, whatever they want to pursue, let them pursue whatever they want, and dies. Then the one who's terrible at music says, Mom, I'm going to go off and become a rock musician. That's what I want to do with my life, and I'm never going to give it up. And the other one says, you know, if he's going to do, I was going to do music, but if he's going to do music, I don't want to. I want to do, I don't know. I want to be a pool cleaner. Is it wrong then, ultimately, for the mother, knowing that both of them are headed for fates that will make them miserable, to say, I want you to know that on his deathbed, your father said he really hoped that you go into music, and he said that he really hopes that you go into computers? I don't want you to answer that question. I just want you to think about it, because that's the equivalent of what Rebecca believes she's doing. She's sending Jacob to the life that will be meaningful for him and will perpetuate the legacy of his father, and allowing Esav to live the life that she thinks will be best for him. Now, you may not like that, but there is at least another case to be made. Yeah, and then I want
to
move on.
Why did she have to trick all of them into this? Why couldn't she, being the manager, she's just talk to her husband about this and do it in a moral, not tricky, lying way? You know what I mean?
Well, the one thing that I would say is we don't know how many conversations Rebecca and Isaac had over the years where she said, don't give the birthright to Esav, you know? Esav, look at him. Look at him out there running around shooting arrows into people. You know, give it to Isaac. So I don't know if she ever tried that. I don't know the answer to that. But for whatever reason, or there is one other possibility, which is the same reason that women were involved in witchcraft far more than men throughout the Middle Ages. Because the usual analysis is that that's how women could wield power. They couldn't wield power in other ways. So who knows whether Isaac said, look, the birthright belongs to me. It's my choice and my decision. And Rebecca was left powerless. And the only way that she could contribute to who got the birthright was tricking him, because it was all in his hands.
So passive. I don't think it was.
You know what? If passive people can assert their power in very brittle ways, but ways that are hard to break through, you know? You can never know. So, yeah.
I suggest that she read page 154 in the explanations. It's a very nice explanation of how Isaac became blind when he saw the light of heaven.
Right.
So he became naive. And so Rebecca felt that she had to...
She had to save him from himself.
Save him and make decisions.
So, I mean, it does, right. If you believe that women... You know, it's like in a modern democracy. We say, why can't someone engage in breaking the law? Because everybody has a vote and gets to change the law. But if you don't have that power, then you have to do it by subterfuge. So for Rebecca, that may be the issue. All right, well, we have a long way yet to go. But let me just, all I'll say is that Jacob goes out and does exactly what she says, right? And she, notice, covers his hands and the hairless part of his neck with the skins of kids. Then she put in the hands of her son Jacob the dish and the bread that she had prepared. In other words, this is entirely Rebecca's operation. It really is. And if you've never read the book of Ruth, which, by the way, is a very short book and a wonderful book, read the book of Ruth and think about and notice how Naomi arranges everything similarly to the way Rebecca does here. Right? It's a great little book in the Bible. It's a fascinating little study. We read it every year on Shavuot, but if you've never read it, read it and pay attention to Naomi, and you'll see how someone who is powerless in society, which Naomi is, manages to use everyone around her to get, in the end, what she wants. All right, see you not next week, but in 2 weeks with Jody Myers, and then we'll resume the story.